Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Hello, everyone. It's nice to be with you again. I'm Richard Martin, and this is the Wake Up Call, coming to you on this Monday, July the 20th, from Penang. Well, thank goodness everything's been fixed. Now that the big shots in the Eurozone have given Greece the Humphrey Bogart treatment, when you're slapped, you'll take it and like it, Bogart's line as he bullied Peter Law in the Maltese Falcon, and a chastened Greece is in line for another 17 billion, or is it trillion? I'm losing track. But anyways, it's all fixed, and squeezing Greek pensioners was the trick needed to save Europe from itself. Now everyone can get back to their summer vacations and the good life resumes. It doesn't get much better than this. That spot of bother in China's stock market has been fixed by criminalizing negative comments about stocks, removing all the stocks that might sink further from trading, and extending more margin to more banana vendors so they can get rich quick too. And since to get rich is glorious, we can anticipate thousands of banana vendors becoming millionaires and rushing to New York to buy a Manhattan cubbyhole for $2 million. When stocks rise, everybody wins. Except those who can no longer afford to live in Manhattan, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Vancouver, etc. But hey, the path is open to them too. Just margin up to the hilt, mortgage your future, and buy stocks now. The People's Bank of China, the Federal Reserve, and the European Central Bank all have your back. Thank goodness that brief stock market swoon is over and the march higher can resume, so everybody can keep winning forever and ever. The deal with Iran is a win-win for everybody too, except consumers who will see oil prices plummet as Iran doubles its production. Of course, that will drive a knife into the heart of every other oil producer's net income, but those sorts of adjustments are good in the long run. Once again, everybody wins. Volatility in the stock market is once again where it should be, at multi-year lows. Low volatility is evidence that everyone's confident that the world's central banks can bail out anyone at any time. Too big to fail banks, every stock market, every real estate bubble, entire nations if need be. Confidence breeds confidence, and complacency means everybody's winning. It's a remarkable feeling knowing the casino has rigged the game in your favour. You can gamble as freely and wildly as your heart desires, and you'll always win. Stocks, up. Condos in Miami, up. Bonds, up. A little negative interest rate action only hurts pensioners and savers. They should get with the program and start buying stocks. Low volatility proves the game is now rigged in everyone's favour. The only losers are those sour pussies who refuse to buy stocks. But it's not too late to turn your banana cart into a condo overlooking Central Park. The trick is to borrow as much as you can and leverage it to the hilt and buy, buy, buy. Remember, everything's fixed. Okay, well, back to reality, I'm afraid. That's what we do best here at the Wake Up Call. So let's have a quick look at the economy to see where we are and maybe where we're headed. Retail sales last month were broadly weak, with receipts at auto dealerships falling 1.1% after rising 1.8% in May. Clothing store sales dropped 1.5%, the largest decline since September 2014. Receipts at building material and garden equipment stores fell 1.3%, and sales at furniture stores declined 1.6%, the biggest drop since January last year. There were also declines in sales at online stores and at restaurants and bars. Rising gasoline prices supported sales at service stations, where receipts rose 0.8%. Coming on the heels of June's disappointing employment report and a sharp drop in small business confidence last month, the weak retail sales data suggests the economy might have lost some momentum at the end of the second quarter, and, as we know, it's been struggling since the beginning of the year. The Philadelphia Federal Reserve's Index of Business Conditions declined to 5.7 this month from 15.7 in June, marking the slowest pace in 4 months. Economists polled by MarketWatch had expected the index to slip to 12.5. Manufacturers also scaled back on staffing. The bank's employment index fell into negative territory for the first time in January and for only the second time in 25 months. The pace of new orders also tapered off. The index for new orders sank to 7.1 from 15.2 in the prior month. The manufacturing sector isn't picking up anytime soon this month, based on the Empire State Index, which came in only just above zero at 3.86. The new orders index, ominously, is in negative ground at minus 3.5. This is the fourth negative reading in 5 months for new orders, which points squarely at slowing overall activity in the months ahead. And hiring this month has slowed to 3.19 versus June's 8.65 in yet another soft signal. Price data show moderation for inputs at 7.45 versus 9.62. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm really the only one who brings you the hard news. In fact, I've been told as much as I talk to many of you about the Destination Penang seminar. I am totally ready to be proven wrong about any or all of this at any time. I am well and truly just the messenger. As the nice man says when I press the button on my machine, you decide. 6 years into a recovery, and with interest rates at record and unnaturally low levels, this kind of gradual slowdown should not be happening. Traditional economic theory says Main Street should be booming, wages should be rising strongly, and inflation should be the emerging risk. The fact that it's not implies that the US and the rest of the world simply can't grow fast enough to reverse the upward trend in the debt-to-GDP ratio. Debts are just rising faster than the ability to pay them down. Pouring trillions of dollars into this bottomless pit has, quite simply, failed. How long does the nightmare have to last before we acknowledge this? Men's egos are very strong. We all know that. But at some point, we have to admit defeat. Well, Alex Tsipras is Greece's prime minister, and he appears to be preparing the nation for a snap general election in September or October after carrying out a government reshuffle that removed dissident ministers from his radical leftist Syriza party. The changes were announced late on Friday and mean that Mr. Tsipras now controls a cabinet more loyal to him and more committed to his path of adopting economic reforms demanded by Greece's Eurozone creditors in return for a new rescue deal worth up to 86 billion euros. the metamorphosis of the radical left Syriza caterpillar Alexander Tsipras into a high centre-right butterfly is nearly complete. Tsipras has become a clone of prior Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras, the centre-right New Democracy leader he vehemently denounced only 6 months ago. Please note that the entirety of the change came between the overwhelming no vote in the July 5th yes-no Greek referendum and Tsipras's breathtaking political transformation on July the 13th, less than 2 weeks later. In the process, we have learnt an important lesson. Complete political metamorphosis of every key position takes no more than 8 days. A new world record. Well, here's a Greek story with a difference, probably, almost certainly, one you are not familiar with, although you've probably heard vague comments to the effect that Goldman Sachs was behind the illicit entry of Greece into the Eurozone. I thought today I'd let you in on what happened here, because it just further points up the odious nature of Wall Street's powers of persuasion and predation, although the street is missing from most accounts. The Greek crisis was exacerbated years ago by a deal with Goldman Sachs, engineered by Goldman's current CEO, Lloyd Blankfein. Blankfein and his Goldman team helped Greece hide the true nature of its debt, and in the process almost doubled it. And just as with the American subprime crisis and the current plight of many American cities, Wall Street's predatory lending played an important, although little recognized, role. In 2001, Greece was looking for ways to disguise its mounting financial troubles. The Maastricht Treaty required all Eurozone member states to show improvement in their public finances, but Greece was heading in the wrong direction. Then Goldman Sachs came to the rescue, arranging a secret loan of 2.8 billion euros for Greece, disguised as an off-the-books cross-currency swap, a complicated transaction in which Greece's foreign currency debt was converted into a domestic currency obligation using a fictitious market exchange rate. As a result, about 2% of Greece's debt magically disappeared from its national accounts. Christoforos Sardelis, then head of Greece's public debt management agency, later described the deal to Bloomberg Business as, quote-unquote, a very sexy story between two sinners. For its services, Goldman received a massive 600 million euros, that's $793 million. According to Spiros Papanikolaou, who took over from Sardelis in 2005, that came to about 12% of Goldman's revenue from its giant trading and principal investments unit in 2001. Which posted record sales that year. The unit was run by Blankfein. Then the deal turned sour. After the 9/11 attacks, bond yields plunged, resulting in a big loss for Greece because of the formula Goldman had used to compute the country's debt repayments under the swap. By 2005, Greece owed almost double what it had put into the deal, pushing its off-the-books debt from 2.8 billion euros to 5.1 billion. In 2005, the deal was restructured, and that 5.1 billion euros in debt locked in. Perhaps not incidentally, Mario Draghi, now head of the European Central Bank and a major player in the current Greek drama, was then managing director of Goldman's international division. Greece wasn't the only sinner. Until 2008, European Union accounting rules allowed member nations to manage their debt with so-called off-market rates in swaps, pushed by Goldman and other Wall Street banks. In the late 1990s, JP Morgan enabled Italy to hide its debt by swapping currency at a favourable exchange rate, thereby committing Italy to future payments that didn't appear on its national accounts as future liabilities. But Greece was in the worst shape, and Goldman was the biggest enabler. Unfortunately, Greece suffers from years of corruption and tax avoidance by its wealthy. But Goldman wasn't an innocent bystander. It padded its profits by leveraging Greece to the hilt, along with much of the rest of the global economy. Other Wall Street banks did the same. When the bubble burst, all that leveraging pulled the world economy down to its knees. Even with the global economy reeling from Wall Street's excesses, Goldman offered Greece another gimmick. In early November 2009, 3 months before the country's debt crisis became global news, a Goldman team proposed a financial instrument that would push the debt from Greece's healthcare system far into the future. This time, though, Greece didn't bite. As we know, Wall Street got bailed out by American taxpayers. And in subsequent years, the banks became profitable again and repaid their bailout loans. Bank shares have gone through the roof. Goldman's were trading at $53 a share in November 2008. Now they're worth over $200. Executives at Goldman and other Wall Street banks have enjoyed huge pay packages and promotions. Blankfein, now Goldman CEO, raked in $24 million last year alone. Meanwhile, the people of Greece struggle to buy medicine and food. There are analogies in America too, beginning with the predatory loans made by Goldman, other big banks, and the financial companies they were allied with in the years leading up to the bust. Today, even as the bankers vacation in the Hamptons, millions of Americans continue to struggle with the aftershock of the financial crisis in terms of lost jobs, savings, and homes. Meanwhile, cities and states across America have been forced to cut essential services because they're trapped in similar deals sold to them by Wall Street banks. Many of these deals have involved swaps analogous to the ones Goldman sold the Greek government. And, much like the assurances it made to the Greek government, Goldman and other banks assured the municipalities that the swaps would let them borrow more cheaply than if they relied on traditional fixed-rate bonds, while downplaying the risks they faced. Then, as interest rates plunged and the swaps turned out to cost far more, Goldman and the other banks refused to let the municipalities refinance without paying hefty fees to terminate the deals. 3 years ago, the Detroit Water Department had to pay Goldman and other banks penalties totaling $547 million to terminate costly interest rate swaps. 40% of Detroit's water bills still go to paying off the penalty. Residents of Detroit, whose water has been shut off because they can't pay, have no idea that Goldman and other big banks are responsible. Likewise, the Chicago school system, whose budget is already cut to the bone, must pay over $200 million in termination penalties on a Wall Street deal that had Chicago schools paying $36 million a year in interest rate swaps. A deal involving interest rate swaps that Goldman struck with Oakland, California, more than a decade ago, has ended up costing the city about $4 million a year. But Goldman has refused to allow Oakland out of the contract unless it ponies up a $16 million termination fee, prompting the city council to pass a resolution to boycott Goldman. When confronted at a shareholder meeting about it, Blankfein explained that it was against shareholder interests to tear up a valid contract. Goldman Sachs and the other giant Wall Street banks are masterful at selling complex deals by exaggerating their benefits and minimizing their costs and risks. That's how they earn giant fees. When a client gets into trouble, whether that client is an American homeowner, a US city, or Greece, Goldman ducks and hides behind legal formalities and shareholder interests. Borrowers that get into trouble are rarely blameless, of course. They spent too much and were gullible or stupid enough to buy Goldman's pitches. Greece brought on its own problems, as did many American homeowners and municipalities. But in all of these cases, Goldman knew very well what it was doing. It knew more about the real risks and costs of the deals it proposed than those who accepted them. "It is an issue of morality," said the shareholder at the Goldman meeting where Oakland came up. Exactly. Well, China's stock market is purportedly all fixed, and Thursday's 6% bounce is just the beginning. Indeed, Goldman Sachs has already reiterated that the whole thing is on the level and that stocks will again be taking flight. China's biggest stock market rout since 1992 has done nothing to erode the bullish outlook of Goldman Sachs Group. Kinger Lau, the bank's China strategist in Hong Kong, predicts the large-cap CSI 300 index will rally 27% from Tuesday's close over the next 12 months as government support measures boost investor confidence and monetary easing spurs economic growth. Leveraged positions aren't big enough to trigger a market collapse, Lau says, and valuations have room to climb. Right. The Chinese economy is in an obvious deepening swoon, and the median company on the Shanghai index had a PE ratio of 60 times before the recent break. But no matter. Not only does everything financial race the skyscrapers to the sky in the land of red capitalism, but valuation upside is apparently whatever the comrades in Beijing want it to be. Says Goldman's chief stock tout for China, quote unquote, "It's not in a bubble yet." Why? Because China's government has a lot of tools to support the market. To be sure, the confident Mr. Kinger Lau was still in diapers when Mr. Deng proclaimed that it was glorious to be rich. Or, stated differently, when Deng set aside Mao's mistaken maxim that power comes from the barrel of a gun in favour of the thoroughly modern notion that prosperity comes from the end of a red-hot printing press. Actually, that's the heart of the matter. Mr. Lau and perhaps 50 million other Chinese punters believe that growth and wealth are gifts of the state. That is, they believe red capitalism works because the comrades in Beijing are always ready to inject whatever it takes by way of stimulus, guidance controls, ever more debt, and now, apparently, prison sentences too, to keep the bubble expanding. That millions of Chinese citizens are being annihilated financially is hardly surprising. After all, the $3.5 trillion lost in the 4 weeks since the June 12th peak was pure casino wealth. It didn't even exist as recently as March the 17th. That's right. The Shanghai Composite first reached the 3,500 level during this trip exactly 60 days before hitting the June 12th high of 5,180. So what amounted to a 50% gain in no time ended up a 30% loss in even less time. There's no need to be pedantic about this. There's no known form of honest economics in which a $3.5 trillion bubble, equal to 35% of GDP, can go through a birth and death cycle in a mere 80 days. Nor should anyone in their right mind believe that the Shanghai Shenzhen casinos have any resemblance to an actual stock market. After all, during Wednesday's plunge, it seemed that trading in 1,350 of the 2,900 companies listed on these exchanges were halted by the companies themselves, and another 750 were halted by 10% limit down rules. Yes, you can apparently stop a selling panic, at least momentarily, when 70% of the names go radio silent, especially when, at the same time, the heavy hand of the state suddenly morphs into the shape of a mailed fist. The desperate comrades in Beijing threw open the People's Printing Press of China to fund ostensibly unlimited margin loans, while simultaneously opening the doors to a cavalcade of paddy wagons instructed to round up anyone with the temerity to sell a stock. And in case the meaning of mobilizing the gendarme was not self-evident, every company which had sold stock during the last 6 months got a personalized order to buy back this same share amount forthwith. All of this desperate action, of course, is only suppressing the problem, not solving it. The trading suspensions cast doubt on authorities' pledge to give markets a greater role in the world's second largest economy. And they mean that the Shanghai Composite Index's 5.9% tumble on Wednesday was probably understated. Investors who got stuck in their positions are turning elsewhere to raise cash, fueling the biggest drop in a month in Chinese government bonds. Indeed, the regulatory authorities in Beijing are so desperate that they are allowing margin calls to be answered by pledging the millions of empty apartment buildings that Chinese punters were earlier lured into acquiring. Now that would make even Charles Ponzi envious. So are these people out of their minds? China is a powder keg of debt. In fact, some $28 trillion worth of it. And, according to the bean counters at McKinsey, upwards of $21 trillion of that was created in just the last 90 months, during which time China's GDP rose by only $5 million. Apparently, even the comrades in Beijing had gotten a tad nervous about the sustainability of creating $4 of debt for each $1 of new GDP. Indeed, their reform plan was to unleash market forces and to encourage companies to shed their mountains of debt by raising equity capital in a vibrant stock market. Well, the stock market got vibrant, all right, and during the past year, several hundred billions of new equity was raised via IPOs and secondary offerings. But the debt P was just being moved under another shell. In fact, Margin debt soared by 5 times in less than 1 year. Nothing like this has occurred anywhere in the world since, well, 1928 to 1929 on Wall Street. But the debt-fueled mania that underpinned America's great crash turns out to be tame by comparison. It appears that China's out-of-control shadow banking system provided again as much and without any rules as to collateral maintenance or the financial capability of borrowers. So compute the sum of combined margin loans from stockbrokers and shadow bankers and express the result in US dollars. What you get is about $800 billion, of which upwards of $600 billion was advanced in just the last 12 months. Now that's 6% of GDP mainlined right into casinos that are 80% comprised of mom-and-pop retail investors. That the resulting bubble has burst and made a mockery of Beijing's market-based reform plans is evident enough. What is truly frightening is that China's authorities are so desperate that they are now attempting to reflate the very same speculative bubble that brought their financial system to the brink. What is even more telling, however, is that the clueless ramblings of a naive kid just out of the London School of Economics gets the Goldman Sachs imprimatur. And that's embarrassing. And it's an embarrassing state of affairs which is the key to the global financial calamity just ahead. As Nixon might have said, they're all Keynesians. Once upon a time, the greybeards of Wall Street would have been horrified by the printing press economics of today's central banks and would have had no trouble at all seeing that China is the greatest eruption of unsustainable debt, wasteful construction, and rampant speculation in human history. It has precisely nothing to do with capitalism or any possible form of sustainable economic growth and wealth creation. In the process of taking its debt from $2 trillion in the year 2000 to $28 trillion at present, in fact, China has erected an endless string of uneconomic public facilities and industrial white elephants that boggle the mind. For instance, it has 1.1 billion tons of steel capacity, 400 to 500 million tons more than its domestic economy will ever be able to use on a sustained sell-through basis. In fact, its excess steel capacity is greater than the total steel industries of the US, Europe, and Japan combined. Likewise, it ramped up a cement industry of 2 billion tons that is double or triple what will be needed when its construction of empty apartment buildings, unused airports, carless highways and bridges, and pointless high-speed rail lines finally comes to an end. Indeed, during the 3 years ending in 2014, China produced more cement than did the US during the entire 20th century. The parade of excess capacity and white elephants is virtually endless and includes copper products, aluminum, solar panels, construction machinery, shipbuilding, and every manner of consumer goods. That used to be called malinvestment, and it's what happens when central banks flood the world with uneconomic credit and governments override every semblance of financial discipline and honest calculation via endless bailouts and safety nets for gamblers. So now China's domestic hothouse has reached the limits of credit-fueled asset expansion. The great maw of its absurdly overbuilt industries is already heaving up deflationary gales on world markets. Its iron ore and steel industries, for example, are literally crashing and flooding markets with more cheap steel than has ever before been imagined. Iron ore, with 60% content delivered to Qingfao, sank 5.1% to $49.60 a dry ton on Tuesday, falling for a ninth day to the lowest since April the 13th, according to Metal Bulletin Limited. Prices entered a bear market on Monday, dropping more than 20% from a June high. On the Dalian Commodity Exchange, futures plunged 7.2% to a record low on Wednesday, while the August contract on Singapore Exchange Limited fell to $42.20. The trend echoes a similar one in steel in the second half of last year, when Chinese exports of excess supplies sent prices tumbling 30%. The nation's aluminium industry quadrupled in the past decade, with smelters churning out record amounts of the metal used in everything from packaging to car bumpers. Metals including nickel and silver on the Shanghai Futures Exchange fell to their daily limits, while rubber entered a bear market. The volume of copper traded was almost six times the three-month average. Steel rebar and iron ore, as well as eggs, sugar, and soybean meal, dropped to the lowest level allowed by their exchanges. Beijing's profoundly stupid attempt to keep the Ponzi scheme going by levitating the stock market is now coming home to roost, domestically as well. An increasing number of car buyers in China are cancelling their purchases and risking forfeiture of their down payments after a stock market rout. According to Kui Dongshu, Secretary General of China's Passenger Car Association, auto sales fell last month for the first time in more than 2 years, quote unquote. "The plunging stock market is essentially a meat grinder, shredding money meant for buying cars." At the end of the day, the firestorm now engulfing the China stock market will shake the regime itself. China's current maximum ruler, Xi Jinping, is self-evidently an economically illiterate thug. Accordingly, there is no measure he will not try in order to arrest the current meltdown. But, as one observer noted, he has put the regime on the line. When the current desperate measures finally fail, China will descend into social and economic chaos. By urging households to buy stocks, Xi has put his credibility, as well as that of the Communist Party, on the line. The stimulus measures' failure may incite outrage among those very mom-and-pop investors who have lost everything. Though it's impossible to tell what might ignite it, mass social unrest in China would shake the entire world. The downside of that wager is profound indeed. The government's creation of the Chinese bull market has disproportionately benefited state-owned companies, and therefore the Communist Party, by replacing government-guaranteed debt with equity. That equity, of course, has been funded by the little guy, the second and much bigger part of the problem. When the state press and government officials began pumping stocks about a year ago, they essentially made a promise to protect the savings of tens of millions of households. The ramification of regime failure in China is surely inestimable. But one thing is certain. The present worldwide faith preached by Goldman and its imitators in the ability of governments and their central banking branches to keep the bubble expanding will suffer a fatal rebuke. None too soon.
Share the truth, invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly, based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin, for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
Well, on Thursday, the cash furnace, otherwise known as Netflix, reported what they euphemistically call earnings. It has no actual earnings. The company has negative operating cash flow, exactly as it has had for a long time. That is, it spends more than it makes. The result? The stock is up roughly 10% after hours and more than 100% this year. This for a company that not only is a cash furnace, the firm says it will continue to do the same thing, burning money like toilet paper. Content costs are rising at double the rate of subscriber increases. In other words, it's not investing for the future in a reasonable time frame. It is simply taking your money as an investor with no reasonable belief you will ever get a single nickel of it back. Buying customers by pricing below cost of operations, yet you continue to buy the shares. Likewise, Amazon has made zero money for 20 years, yet the stock continues to advance in price. Based on what exactly? Is Bezos Jesus? Apparently so, according to the media and so-called analysts. And you, Mr. and Mrs. American, who keep buying that trash. Amazon may be a good company to buy from as a consumer, but that does not make the firm a reasonable investment when for more than two decades there has been zero return of capital to its owners. Intel this week supposedly beat the street. No, it didn't. It dropped its tax provisioning and operating income was down big, confirming the fact that it actually lost in real terms on both a sequential and year-over-year basis. I'm not the only one to note this. Motley Fool also picked up on it. Well, duh, I can read a balance sheet and income statement. And so can they, apparently. Yet the firm didn't see its stock price get slammed. Yes, the big pump came off to a material degree, but it's still up. All right, let's take an email from David Walsh. Thank you for that link to the Varoufakis interview, Richard. I think Varoufakis confirms my conviction. The Eurocrats are operating to an agenda. But it is not the publicly affirmed agenda. They're not doing what it says on the tin. There is an inherent logic in their actions, but it is not the logic people imagine based on the publicly affirmed policies. That is why their actions seem illogical, or stupid, if you prefer. They are operating to a different agenda than they publicly declare. For instance, their publicly affirmed policy was to negotiate a workable deal for Greece with the Greek government that would resolve the debt crisis and restore the Greek economy. But as Varoufakis says, in actuality, they refused to negotiate. The Eurocrats have an agenda for Greece. The only purpose of the negotiations for them was to implement that agenda. In my opinion, the Eurocrats' agenda is coming from a level of power above the Eurocrats, by which I mean above Merkel and Hollande, etc. In my view, the Greek crisis is not essentially about debt. That's just the weapon and instrument of leverage. It's about economic and social engineering. Regards, David. Oh, David, that's pretty profound and thoughtful, and I thank you for it. So, Steve Humphrey wrote in, and he had this to say. Hi, Richard. You recently mentioned the option of depositing money in foreign banks, for example, Hong Kong, Singapore, or Australia. I noticed there are branches of banks from these countries in most major US cities, but it occurs to me that foreign banks doing business here might be subject to the same restrictions imposed on US banks. Is it simply a matter of opening an account at one of these branches, or is it necessary that the funds actually be deposited overseas? And if so, how do you do this? Also, do foreign banks have the equivalent of FDIC protection? Feel free to reply on the air if you prefer. Thanks, as always, Steve Humphrey. All right. Well, Steve, there is a little bit of a misunderstanding here, because I did mention the option of depositing money in foreign banks, but I didn't mean the US branches of said foreign banks. No. Every country has its own banking rules and regulations, and all the banks in that country must abide by those rules and regulations. So if a Hong Kong or a Singapore bank is doing business in the US, it will have to abide by the US regulations. So you don't want to use the US branches of those banks. You do want to take your money to the home countries and open up an account at one of their branches locally. This is done by simple wire transfer. You can transfer your money from your US bank to a foreign bank, normally without trouble, although I am hearing that there has been trouble. That the US banks are now throwing up obstacles and creating difficulties. And as I've said in the past, these kinds of red flags are a warning that further trouble can be expected down the line. And by further trouble, I mean the possibility of exchange controls fully applied to all American citizens trying to get money out of the country. So this is something that I have feared, and I have told you that I would bring to your attention, and I have done so in the past, and I am doing so here again today on record as saying that, yes, it is time to start thinking about opening accounts in foreign banks. And that is one of the things we will be talking about in Destination Penang, the seminar that will be taking place in Penang from August the 23rd to the 28th. We will be talking about opening bank accounts, and there will be a banker as one of the lecturers, one of the speakers at the seminar, who will be walking you through that process and facilitating your so doing. So again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have not yet signed up for this and you are of a mind to do so, please do. We are now a month away, and time is moving on. There are still spaces. We are taking a maximum of 20 people, but nevertheless, don't delay, because you never know, we will not take more than 20. I've already said that I think that Johnny's 25 limit is probably too much for us. We want to allow the attendees to have as much exposure to the lecturers as possible, and I feel that 20 people is about as much as we can really usefully accommodate at our seminar in August. If we find that we have more time than we need, then we may up it if we ever decide to do a future seminar, which is not yet, of course, mooted. I would rely upon the good graces of my dear wife and her board of directors at the International Women's Association before I could ever promise you anything like that. But nevertheless, try to make it, if you can, in August from the 23rd to the 28th. Okay, well, apparently Greek banks purportedly will open on Monday after having been shut for about 2 weeks. Is there a cash? You bet there is. Banks will be open for, quote-unquote, all services which do not give rise to capital flight, and capital controls will remain in place. Want to make a deposit? Sure, that'll be allowed. Discover you just made a mistake? Miscalculated, did we? Want your money back? Well, you're going to have a problem getting it. How big a problem? Well, we'll find out today. To give appearance to the idea that things are improving, I suspect customers will find they can take out another, say, 10 euros or so per day, perhaps 70 euros, up from the current 60. If my guess is correct, and you are foolish enough to have 25,550 euros in the bank, it'll take you a year to get out your money, even if you religiously take out the minimum, or the maximum rather, per day. Of course, that assumes everyone else does not do the same, because if they do, the ECB will put a hold to it. So, apparently they really did put capital controls on to prevent widespread bank runs and to keep money leaving the country. And when they first created these mandates earlier this month, they were only supposed to be in place for a short period of time. But now it looks like the Greeks may be facing a long-term banking crisis. On Wednesday, Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras made a statement that should have Greeks dreading the next few weeks. In a televised interview, he stated, quote-unquote, "The reopening of the banks depends on the sanctioning of the deal, which will take place in a month." So, the citizens of Greece can look forward to long lines at the ATM and cash shortages throughout August. Keep in mind, for when America's debt crisis finally blows up, you don't own the money that you put in the bank, in your account. It belongs to the bank, and it's insured and regulated by the government, which is bought and paid for by the banks with the money you put in their accounts. By the time the system falls apart, you'll have needed to see the writing on the wall and got your money out. Because once the crisis starts, your savings will be handed over to the authorities and rationed out at their leisure. Those of you coming to Penang with the Destination Penang Group in August will get an earful of this from the banking representative, so be prepared. The news is not good. But there will be a denominated bank account in dollars here where your money will be safe. Well, imagine for a moment that the euro had never been introduced, and we instead had freely floating European currencies, and each country would have been free to choose their own monetary policy and fiscal policy. Some countries would have been doing well, other countries would have been doing badly. But do you seriously think that we would have a crisis as deep as what we have seen over the past 7 years in Europe? Do you think Greek GDP would have dropped 30%? Do you think Finland would have seen a bigger accumulated drop in GDP than during the Great Depression? Or during the banking crisis of the 1990s? Do you think that European taxpayers would have had to pour billions of euros into bailing out Southern European and Eastern European governments? And German and French banks? Do you think that Europe would have been as disunited as we're seeing it now? Do you think we would have seen the kind of hostilities among European nations as we're seeing now? Do you think we would have seen the rise of political parties like Golden Dawn and Syriza in Greece or Podemos in Spain? Do you think anti-immigrant sentiment and protectionist ideas would have been rising across Europe to the extent it has? Do you think that the European banking sector would have been quasi-paralyzed for 7 years? And most importantly, do you think we would have had 23 million unemployed Europeans? Well, ladies and gentlemen, the answer to all these questions is no. We would have been much better off without the euro. The euro is a major economic, financial, political, and social fiasco. It's disgusting, and I blame the politicians of Europe and the Eurocrats for this, and I blame the economists who failed to speak out against the dangers of introducing the euro and instead gave their support to a project so economically insane that it could only ever have been envisioned by the type of people the British historian Paul Johnson called intellectuals. And don't say you weren't warned. Milton Friedman had warned you that forced monetary integration would cause political disunity and would be an economic disaster. He was, of course, right. Bernard Connolly, who wrote the book The Rotten Herd of Europe, warned exactly against what is going on now. Nobody wanted to listen. In fact, Bernard Connolly was sacked from the European Commission in 1995 for speaking his mind. The sacking of Bernard Connolly is telling of the lack of debate about monetary policy matters in Europe. Any opposition to the project is silenced. Well, let me tell you, the greater proof always comes first. Only in a few countries have there been referenda about euro adoption. In Denmark and Sweden, the electorate have been wise enough to go against the orders of the euro establishment. As a consequence, both countries today are better off than if the electorate had followed the orders of the elite and voted yes to euro adoption. It's easy to understand the frustration of the European voters. They have been lied to. Unfortunately, the outcome is that voters across Europe are now happy to vote for parties like Front Nation, UKIP, Podemos, and Syriza. I ask you, the cheerleaders of the Euro project, is this what you wanted? I can only say that I understand the Greek population's anger over 7 years of economic and social hardship, and I likewise understand that the taxpayers of Finland don't want to pay for yet another meaningless bailout of Greece. But you should not blame each other. You should blame the European politicians who brought the job into the euro. Blame the Euros who never understood how it helped to get his great book of Victor Sun's seat. The curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they really know about what they imagine they can design. The euro is a fatal conceit. Mario Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, Europeans' equivalent to the Federal Reserve, just admitted that ECB exposure to Greek debt is 130 billion euros. In other words, out of the approximately 300 billion euros outstanding, the European Central Bank has roughly half of it and is thus exposed to a 100% loss on the entire sum should Greece walk off. So if you are wondering how they wound up with that exposure, I have the answer. After the first two bailouts, They, shall we say, bought it from the commercial banks that formerly had it, transferring the risk from private concerns that had taken it on with the intent to make a profit to the entirety of the EU citizenry. Let me remind you that the European Central Bank has single-digit billions in capital. Their leverage on this debt alone is well over 10 to 1 without any exposure to anything else. Given that everyone says that Greece cannot pay the European Central Bank is factually bankrupt right there, right now. That's right, as of now, based on every independent financial analytical opinion out there, including the IMF, the BIS, the now resigned Greek finance minister and Tsipras himself, the European Central Bank, is technically bankrupt, quite simply because its bad debts exceed its capital, and that by a significant amount. That's because all of that bogus Greek debt, official and otherwise, was shoved onto the ECB's balance sheet over the previous 4 years, so the various banks, including most of the big banks in Europe that had loaned Greece money, wouldn't have to take the loss themselves and potentially blow up. Understand this, ladies and gentlemen. There is no way to prevent the blow-up from happening. Well, all right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Our hour is up and my time is up. And so this is the end of the show. I will be back on Friday. Have a wonderful week ahead. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.
And there you have it. You decide.